Lecture 15, Hermeticism, Astrology, Alchemy, and Magic.
Welcome to Lecture 15. In Lecture 14, I look at the Renaissance and the awareness of deep time, and I introduce a discussion of these four esoteric forms of knowledge: astrology, alchemy, magic, which I will do later on in greater detail, and hermeticism, which I want to essentially dedicate most of the time today. Now, please understand, and again I emphasize, that these are knowledges which we dismiss today as superstition, or which we think of them as insignificant, but that there is no European court, or indeed no papal court, in the 15th and 16th century that did not have an astrologer, that did not have a magus. The figure of the magus, dressed in a robe with planets and stars and a pointed hat, was a very common figure in the Europe of the late Renaissance and the early modern period. He played a very significant role. No pope, no great ruler will go around without having his horoscope erected. Today we dismiss it. It's the kind of things in the back of the paper which people read for fun. I hope that no one really truly believes in it. But it has been dismissed and in a sense defeated by science. There is, however, a connection between astrology and astronomy, and I will talk about that later on. Astrology, of course, goes back also to the beginnings of times. The ziggurats, the great towers that we find in Mesopotamia, were really observatory towers to see and trace the movements of planets and stars. It went on into Greece, where all the constellations and the signs of the zodiac are given names, Greek names, and so on. And from there, it passes on to the Arabs. It, in a sense, it is one important element of a Stoic philosophy. That is to say, the sympathy between the world of man and the world of the cosmos. The link, as I said in the previous lectures, as Ficino discussed it, the link that exists between the macrocosm, that of the cosmos, and the microcosm, that of the soul of man. And in that, Ficino will argue in his Theologia Platonica, it is something that makes men and women the equal of angels, because we have the same link between ourselves and the world of stars and planets that the angels do. Augustine of Hippo, the great Christian doctor of the church, was in an earlier stage of his life, before he converted to Christianity, a believer in astrology. But it is in the Renaissance where astrology acquires a very unique place, where astrology becomes essentially all important. Because it is Ficino, among others, who develops a doctrine. Ficino who argues that he does not believe in astrology. Nonetheless, he develops a doctrine about the 12 natures of man that correspond to the 12 houses in the zodiac, that there is a relationship, that you must lead your life according to the sign under which you are born, or the sign that dominates your life. It is also that there are superior natures attached to these spheres, to these 12 spheres, and the way is how to connect with them through the use of certain amulets, through the eating of certain fragrances, the smelling of certain fragrances, to the eating of certain substances, very much as today people will carry a stone, which would be the birth stone, a stone that is associated with your astrological sign, which is supposedly bring some of the powers of above into you. But there's a serious problem here, of course, because astrology, though accepted throughout Italy, though popes themselves were great patrons of astrologers and magus, nonetheless, astrology denies free will. And therefore, it is always a contradiction in terms that astrology is so popular in this period, which is, of course, at the same time, such a Christian period. Let me talk to you very briefly about two astrologers to give you a sense of the power that these astrologers could achieve the kind of prestige that they will have. And we will go back to astrology when we talk about Hermeticism, because Hermetic beliefs, in a sense, are shot through and through with astrological lore. Let me talk to you about Luca Guarico, born in the middle of the 15th century, one of the most important astrologers of the late 15th century. He predicted the fall of Giovanni Bentivoglio, the tyrant of Bologna, was in prison because of his predictions, but it came to happen. That is to say, he was shown to be right. Then he predicted that Alessandro Farnese would become pope. And when Farnese became Paul III, became pope and took the name of Paul III, he, as a reward for this accurate prediction, made Luca Guarico into a bishop. So here you have a bishop of the Catholic Church just a few years before the Reformation. So which gives you a sense of when we were talking about Martin Luther and the climate in which the Protestant Reformation took place, then here is an important astrologer who is turned into a bishop. That is to say, he gets the income of a bishop and the title of a bishop because of his predictions. He predicted the manner and the date of the Pope's death, and it came to happen too. In 1493, Guarico announced that Giovanni de' Medici would be Pope within 20 years, and that he was and became Pope in 1513. He then predicted that Giulio de' Medici would have, who also became a Pope, would have many children, and he had 26 bastard children. That was the Pope, which gives you also an idea about the climate in which these people work. Clearly, Luca Guarico is on a roll, and he's doing exceedingly well. In fact, he's doing so well, and he's so attached to the Medici family, that Caterina de' Medici takes him to France with her when she becomes Queen of France. And there, his first prediction was that Henry II, King of France, will live a long and prosperous life. Soon afterwards, he died in a tournament. So much for Luca Guarico. Obviously, he was not altogether correct all the time. In 1524, just before the Great Peasant Uprising, there was a great conjunction of the planets, and there was great fear throughout the West that this might, in a sense, indicate some great catastrophe. An astrologer called Nifo wrote on 24 December 1519, predicted that there will be a conjunction in February 1524, and that that conjunction, because it took place in the sign of Pisces, will bring great floods into the world, and the world will suffer complete devastation. When in 1524 it began to rain in the month of March, great rains, people, in fact, began to pay attention to this prediction. And many people began to move into high ground or to build arks as a way of escaping this great flood. Of course, it happens that, of course, around 1524, a new illness began to spread quite rapidly throughout Europe. That was the Morbus Gallicus, or syphilis, which had appeared in the early 16th century and which was seen by many as a result of this planetary conjunction. I would like to point out that, of course, the flood did not come, and it was shown that it was, in fact, an inaccurate prediction, but that there are people at the University of Salamanca and other universities who spent considerable amount of time trying to show that this was incorrect, that this was not so. So much for this prediction. It is not until the 17th century that there is a true reaction against astrology, that there is an attack in astrology. And as we shall see later on, some of the most important works of literature in this period are really attacks against astrology. I'm thinking specifically now of Julius Caesar, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, who will say it is not in the stars, but in ourselves, that we are not dominated by the stars, that our life is not, in a sense, shaped by the influence of the stars. That is astrology. I would like to conclude this discussion of astrology by pointing out that some of the most important physical work and some of the most important astronomical deductions and works were really the result of essentially astrological observation. One of the most important astrologers was Tycho Brahe, the man who made the clearest and most accurate observations of a star and planetary motion before the invention of the telescope. And it is Tycho Brahe's calculations, which were used to erect horoscopes for which he was paid immense amounts of money, that would be used by Kepler to, in a sense, enunciate his planetary laws on planetary motion. And it's not that he did this observation, but that he used the observations of Tycho Brahe. And so in many respects, it is a way in which the careful observation of the skies leads, and the skies in the 16th century look very different from the way in which the skies look now. And I want to make that point and emphasize that point, because it is very difficult for us to understand what the skies meant for people who live in the 16th century or the period before that. We barely see stars now because either light pollution or general pollution prevents us from seeing the skies as they did look to people in the 16th and 17th century. So in a sense, there is this preoccupation with the heavens, which is perhaps less so today, where we cannot really contemplate the magnificence of the stars. Alchemy is a very different pursuit altogether. Alchemy is also very ancient. It goes back to Chaldean formulas, to Babylonian traditions, and so on. It is said that in the great library at Alexandria, which was burned long ago, there was the greatest collection of alchemical treatises. And that if you can get your hands into one of these alchemical treatises, you can really do what they pretend to do. Now, we associate alchemy essentially with the idea of the transmutation of metals, that is to say, with the turning of lead into gold. But alchemy was, in fact, far more than that. Alchemy was probably, in many respects, a kind of religion. It was the way in which the alchemist, this mysterious, esoteric figure, working in his, we could call it laboratory, though they call it something else. They call it in language which was impregnated with religious symbolism. It was the altar. It was the crucible. And there he will torture matter until he will bring out of that matter the essence, the water, the divine water, which they identified with the soul of the world, with the anima mundi. And this, of course, was related to a great Platonic dialogue entitled the Timaeus, in which the soul of the world, the anima mundi, serves as a link between the unknowable God and mankind. So essentially what the alchemist was all about, or at least some alchemists, they were about the discovery of that essence of the world, which is extracted by torturing metals in the crucible, which will essentially contain that ingredient, that soul of the world, the anima mundi, which was in some respects an essence which went beyond the four known parts or components of matter. It was not either earth or fire, or wind, or water. It was a different kind of essence which contained in itself all the meanings of the universe. In many respects, what the alchemists are all about is to grasping this, by reaching the philosopher's stone, acquiring all the knowledge, all the wisdom of the world. And the language they use is essentially a religious language. It's a mysterious language. It is also, as Jung has pointed out in his great alchemical studies, a language which is filled with references to hermaphrodites. In that respect, what they are trying to do is a conjunction of opposites brought together into one. Therefore, the hermaphrodite, a figure which is very important in antiquity, but which disappears altogether in the Middle Ages, that human that has both male and female genitalia, becomes an important ingredient, an important component of all alchemical elements. Alchemy remains alive, as I said to you in the previous lecture, as a pursuit very late as the 18th century in Europe, where people, in a sense, continue to be preoccupied with a way of reaching out and discovering a form of knowledge which will open to them all the wisdom of the universe, so that some very important men, including Newton and Boyle and others, are really people who dabble and are very concerned and very interested in questions of, in a sense, alchemical research and alchemical studies. The third ingredient is magic. And again, I want to point out that all these traditions, astrology, magic, hermeticism, and all that, are all linked together, and they all essentially have elements of one and the other. The magus is an astrology. The magus is also someone who has certain knowledge of certain incantations and formulas which allow them essentially to have control over the world. In the next lecture, I will talk about magic and religion. But the magus plays a very important role in the late Renaissance and in the early modern period. There are two great magical treatises. One is the Picatrix, which is named and referred to in documents of the period, but which there are very few people who have access to them. It contains all kinds of formulas, ways of constructing amulets. There are two different kinds of magic. One, of course, is malefic magic, demonic magic, in which you contact and link with evil spirits. And then there is a benefic magic. And magic, of course, is one of those traditions which, in a sense, bridges the gulf between high and low. Because also part of that magical tradition, and very popular throughout Europe, are healers. The old women who lived on the edge of town and who, through herbal medicine and through certain potions and so on, can cure, or by the touch of her hand, can cure illnesses. Remember this, because these people are going to be a very particular target of the witch craze. These are people who are going to be identified not as magicians practicing some kind of benefic magic, but practicing a malefic form of magic, and they are going to pay with their lives for that. The Wolf's Turn book, also a great collection of magical incantations and so on, which circulates among a small intellectual elite and which is supposed to be of great importance. It is calculated that in the Paris of the 16th century, 30,000 people identify themselves as either astrologers or magicians or sorcerers or some kind or another, which gives you a sense, although I think this is an exaggerated figure, which gives you a sense and an idea of how relevant and important this is. In Castile, I know from looking at documents there that there is a sort of people who go around little villages selling their services as people who will bring rain in terms of drought, or chase hailstorms, or chase locust plagues, and so on. People who certain, in a sense, way in which they will say certain incantations will alter and control nature. And I want to point out to you that the ongoing importance, or should we say, of the magic tradition in our society as well, of the popularity of such books as Harry Potter or The Lord of the Rings. Today in the New York Times, there is a story about the popularity, in the US Today, about the popularity of The Lord of the Rings, which in a sense points out about the attraction of the magician, of the magus, to this very day. And finally, of course, to hermeticism, which is what I want to spend the rest of this lecture. If you visit Siena and visit the Duomo is, of course, the name we use for all the cathedrals, the Duomo of Milan, the Duomo of Florence, the Duomo of Siena, which is a very beautiful church in a very beautiful town. And you enter into the portal of the church, into the vestibule, the entrance to the church. There on the floor of the church, in graffiti, which is a form of mosaic work, there are two figures. On the one hand is Moses, and on the other one is a representation of Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes the three times great, dressed as a magus, dressed in a long robe, covered with the stars and moons, and wearing the pointed hat of the Magus. When the Duomo was built or rebuilt, the people who are essentially thinking this building, who are constructing this building, had no questions or doubts that Hermes Trismegistus was the equal of Moses. And they placed him in this sacred Christian place because they believe, deeply believe, and will believe so until the beginning of the 17th century, and even beyond that, that Hermes Trismegistus has written works which contained a kind of learning and knowledge which was equal to that of Moses. I already told you the story of how the Corpus Hermeticum, the body of hermetical writings, come together with the Asclepius, which is another important hermetical writings, come to Florence into the hands of Marsilio Ficino in the middle of the 15th century, and how it's translated ahead of Plato's Symposium, because it is considered to be a work of greater antiquity, a work far closer to the sources of truth, close to the very beginning of human existence. In reality, the Corpus Hermeticum was written between 100 and 300 AD, or of the Common Era. In reality, the Corpus Hermeticum was a mumble jumble, a collection of sometimes even contradictory texts, mostly of Gnostic origin. Gnosticism being a pseudo-philosophical religious movement emerging out of Christianity and of the decline and collapse of ancient philosophy. It combined philosophical, astrological, magical elements brought together, including in the Asclepius, a story about the creation of the world, which paralleled Genesis. Of course it did, because it was borrowing from Genesis, but which Renaissance men, scholars, those who read and translated this and studied this, thought to be essentially a description of the world written by Thoth, an Egyptian priest or a great god, and transcribed by Hermes, the messenger of the gods, who is here represented to us as Hermes Trismegistus. This collection of works, the Corpus Hermeticum and the Asclepius, contains both optimistic and fatalistic philosophies of points of view. In some respects, these optimistic and pessimistic views, which we find both in the Corpus Hermeticum, lead or yields the same result. Either you have to find some substance that will, in a sense, protect you from the nefarious influence of the stars, or you find some substance that will bring down the beneficial aspects of the stars and the planets. The world is an animal, according to the Hermetic tradition, according to Ficino. The stars and the planets are living animals as well. That which links one world to the other is by certain products, by certain things, by eating sugar and cinnamon. Sugar is very important in the culture of the 16th century. It's a rare and costly commodity. So sugar, eating pure sugar, or eating cinnamon, spices, or smelling roses, in a sense allow you to connect. But what you are really seeking here is to find that link between the material world and the spirit of the world. And for the Corpus Hermeticum and for Ficino, that link was, of course, ether, which they call la quinta esencia, the fifth essence, that which in a sense serves as a bridge between matter and the world, between the microcosm and the macrocosm. You listen to music, because that's the way in which you get essentially to that moment in which you can bridge the difference, you can bridge the space between one and the other. Plato and Pythagoras have argued that the harmonic qualities of both the macro and the micro are one and the same. And that if you can, in a sense, link through music, because for ancients, music was essentially mathematics, mathematical proportions, octaves, then you can, in a sense, understand the meaning of the world and grasp the beneficial aspects of that world or prevent its negative aspects. And the most important of all music was not Orphic music, but a different kind of music. This is actually my favorite part of Marsilio Ficino, one that since I was a young man, I was always attracted to, and which finds echoes in the culture of early modern Europe. Ficino argues, this is not in the Corpus Hermeticus, this is Ficino's invention, that as the stars and the planets rotate in their orbits, in the circle of their orbits, in the kind of Ptolemaic conception of the universe, which is going to be dethroned in a few years by the Copernican revolutions, as the stars and the planets move and the sun and the moon, they produce a music. And that this is the music of the spheres. And that if we can, in a sense, collect or hear or attune ourselves by, as I said, the eating of certain substance, to listen to that music, then we have discovered the meaning of the universe. In many respects, the planet and the stars still produce music. We can collect that sounds in our radio telescopes. It is the music that the universe makes as it turns and gyrates and moves into endless space. Think how powerful this idea was for the culture of the age. Think of people like Botticelli, that great painting, Primavera, which you can see in the Uffizi Palace in Florence, which is written because a friend of Botticelli, of Sandro Botticelli, named Girolamo Benibeni, wrote to him a letter which included all this about the mysteries of the Renaissance, and which he conveys to us in that extraordinary painting, which is filled with allusions about magic, hermeticism, and astrology. Think of the work of Shakespeare. Think of The Tempest, which is nothing but a rejection of magic. When Prospero drowns his books, when he drowns the Beatrix, you could say, when he drowns the books of magic, he is joining the world and rejecting magic, as all the works reject magic and astrology. Think of The Alchemist by Ben Jonson, which tells us about, essentially, the world of the alchemist and the magician. Think of John Donne's poetry, specifically a very beautiful poem entitled The Valediction, Forbidding Morning, in which he, in a sense, calls in all kinds of references about the movement of the spheres, about sublunary worlds, which reflects that world which was so powerful and so intense that dominated European culture and which was, as we speak, as we describe it, almost in the moment of its death, before it would be, in a sense, should we say it, marginalized, thrown back into a world of superstition, before it would be replaced by a new religion which is growing the horizon. And that religion was, of course, science. But the science of the 16th and 17th century, that great scientific revolution, was grounded and based upon these mysteries, which gives us a very different side of the Renaissance, a very different picture of what those on the top believe, wrote, and practiced as they went to the business of understanding and grabbing and grasping the meaning of the world. Thank you.